Commentator Firouzeh Dumas has her own story about food and the holidays. Here's her tale.
I'm 8 years old. It's the week before Christmas. I'm watching the Sonny and Cher Christmas special with my parents. There's no smell of nutmeg wafting through this house, and no gifts anywhere. Such is the life of a secular Muslim immigrant in this land, where Santa Claus visits a lot of people, but not us. Fast forward 17 years. I'm married to my French Catholic husband. I have a stocking hanging on the mantle with my name on it, Firouzeh, F-I-R-O-O-Z-E-H. It had to be specially ordered. That first Christmas together was magical. The next year, François decided it was time to include my parents. I want them to experience a French Christmas meal, he said. For the next 3 weeks, all our conversations centered around the menu. Would your parents like carpaccio? No. Would they try quail eggs? No. Bone marrow on toast? Dad, yes. Mom, definitely no. My parents arrived on December 25th in jovial moods. This would be their first real Christmas meal, and they came laden with gifts. Open them now, my parents insisted. Once we opened all the gifts, my mother announced, "One more for François. François, I make you carrot jam with pistachio. I know you like." She sprinted into the living room and came back with my father's carry-on bag. "You put it in my bag?" my father asked. As my mother opened my father's favorite bag, a look of horror came upon her face. The jam had spilled. My father leapt to his feet. Everything was covered with sticky, orange goo, interspersed with slivers of pistachio. "Why did you have to put the stupid jam in my bag?" he yelled at my mom. "It was for François," my mother said, invoking the name of her new son-in-law as some sort of human shield. "Maybe he can eat my bag," my father suggested. For the first course, François had cured salmon. My mother picked at her gravlax and asked me in Persian what else there was. "In khame, it's raw," she said. "It's salmon," said François, guessing from my mother's scrunched-up face that there was a problem. "Is good," my mother said to him. I explained to her in Persian that a scrunched-up face means the same thing in French and English as it does in Persian. "Why didn't you tape the lid on the jam jar?" my father asked, reaching for the bread. "I did," my mother said. "I didn't see any tape," my father said. "What kind of tape did you use?" "Please stop, Baba," I told my father. "I just want to know what kind of tape she used," he said. The next course, quail stuffed with foie gras and served in a porcini mushroom sauce, evoked oohs and ahs from everyone. "What is in this?" my mother asked. After François explained what foie gras was, my parents didn't touch it. "Can I talk to you for a moment?" We went upstairs. "Why won't your parents eat anything?" he asked. "They love you, but this is a new adventure for them. Did I mention that they love you?" Back downstairs, my husband François went in the kitchen to make coffee. "Firouzeh!" he yelled. I ran into the kitchen. "Look!" he said, pointing to the Yule log which he had spent the entire previous day preparing. Marzipan mushrooms, chocolate holly leaves. Looked okay to me. "Look inside." That's when I noticed the mocha buttercream filling in the Yule log was missing 2 inches on each end. "Your parents ate this while we were upstairs, probably with their fingers," he said. François cut off both ends of the Yule log and tossed them in the trash. The Yule stump was the one part of the meal that my parents ate with gusto. "The inside is the best," they told François. As we cleared the plates, my parents thanked François profusely. "François, thank you so very much. The best Christmas ever, very best," my mother gushed. The Frenchman and I cleaned the kitchen while my parents sat on the sofa admiring the Duraflame. François took down the Armagnac from the cabinet. As he poured the drinks into tiny glasses, I heard for the first time the Sinatra record that had been playing in the background the entire evening. And then I heard my father's voice. Nazijun, why couldn't you have just put the jam in your bag?
Weather outside is frightful, but that fire is delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Firouzeh Dumas wrote the books Laughing Without an Accent and Funny in Farsi.
It has been a big year for big numbers. For the next few minutes, we're going to try to make sense of those numbers. To begin, a number we can all manage, one. Here's the sound of one guy talking.
So in every day, you can count on it.
Now, 100 people. And with a little help from technology, we can approximate a million. Sounds a little like rushing water, which is just how big numbers can sound on the news.
We'll invest $15 billion a year
over the next decade. $25 billion.
Most of the $350 billion has
$455.
The government would spend up to $700 billion to buy troubled
tens of millions of dollars.
Some estimates are putting it at close to $1 trillion.
To help take some of the blur out of those bazillions, we invited economist Andrew Dilnot and journalist Michael Blostland into our London studios. They hosted a BBC radio show all about numbers called More or Less. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you.
Now, you know, may I just start actually with you, Andrew Dilnot, the economist here. We've just heard some numbers, $700 billion for America's financial bailout. Do you find that number shocking?
Not really. Without setting it in context, and setting numbers in context is what Michael and I really feel passionate about, it's hard to know whether it's big or little. Is $700 billion a lot of money? Well, the total national income of the United States is nearly $15 trillion, or 15,000 billion. So $700 billion is about 5% of national income for the US. The kind of number for the car bailout, I think, about $15 billion. Well, Michael or I, and I suspect you wouldn't mind a small slice of that, but $15 billion is just $1 a week for every person in the US for 1 year. So maybe it isn't such a big number. And that's one of the things we really want people to do, to cut numbers down to size, make them personal, and that way you can work out whether they're big, small, or just kind of average.
Michael Blostland, get in here, if you would, and give us some other examples of numbers that it's a bit hard to get our heads around, but it can be done, that we've been hearing this year.
Well, one useful trick is to imagine those numbers instead as seconds. And a million seconds is about 11 and a half days. A billion seconds? I won't ask you to work it out. A billion seconds is nearly 32 years. Just to remind ourselves that one is 1,000 times greater than the other. And that actually, yeah, they've both got a lot of zeros on the end, but those extra three zeros make quite a bit of difference in many cases.
Do you all think that large numbers are even harder to understand because we don't really pull out a lot of cash at any given moment? We're generally using credit cards, or for that matter, passing around numbers on a computer screen.
I suspect it may well be true that our own personal engagement with numbers matters. There's a lovely story told by a neuroscientist in the UK about how good people were at doing arithmetic, depending on where they lived. And it turned out that people from Italy who'd started to suffer from dementia were still very, very much better at doing sums with thousands and millions in them than people from the rest of Europe. And the explanation for that was that before we had the euro as the European currency, people who lived in Italy had the lira, and because there'd been quite a lot of inflation in the past in Italy, you had lots and lots of thousands of lira. If you went into a shop to buy something, you would be buying in thousands. So yes, I think that it's very hard for us to deal with numbers that are outside our normal range of experience.
It's Michael here. We did ask people, we went out into the street and just said to people, how much do you think this government, the British government, spends on health each year? And we gave them some choices and we said, is it £7 million a year? Is it 70, 700 million? Is it 7 billion or even 7 trillion? And the amazing thing is that we got all those answers. People really struggle enormously as soon as the words million or billion are added to numbers.
Well, are numbers themselves getting bigger? I mean, after this recession is over, do you see a day when corporations will report earnings or losses, if it comes to that, in trillions?
I think we will be using numbers with more and more zeros. it probably won't get any harder for us than it is already, because while the numbers for the economy as a whole will have more and more zeros, so will the number for our paycheck, the number for the value of our house. So our own experiences will kind of keep up with the numbers.
Here's another number. Thanks to the two of you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a delight.
Michael Blastlund is a journalist and Andrew Dilnot is an economist. Their new book is called The Numbers Game, The Common Sense Guide to Understanding Numbers in the News, in Politics, and in Life. For more than 25 years, an MIT professor has asked her students to think back in their lives to when they first began to think or behave like a scientist. Was there an object, a microscope, a radio, a Lego set that they found fascinating? That professor, Sherry Turkle, recently published a selection of those essays, and our science correspondent, Robert Krulwich, really liked this one.
When Joe Calzaretta was 2 years old, there was this thing at the end of his block. It was at the corner.
I didn't know what it was, but I knew that there were letters on it, but I didn't know what they meant.
What he saw was a pole that kind of came up out of the ground, and fastened onto the top of the pole was this oddly shaped...
I knew it was this red octagonal thing.
Where was this, by the way?
It was Staten Island.
Okay, Staten Island in New York. And when Joe said to his mom and dad, well, what is that thing? The parents said, well, Joey, that's a stop sign, which meant absolutely nothing to him.
Exactly. Yes.
So they took him to the corner, and they showed him that any time a car, a bus, even a truck came up to that stop sign, it stopped.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just the occasional car. It was all the cars.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, that's some power, especially to a two-year-old.
For the first time in his life, Joe realized there are rules in the world that don't come from people, from a policeman or a mommy or a daddy. This one was just on the sign in a four-letter code.
That these four letters, these four glyphs on this object actually had this rule contained in them.
What's more, the rule worked. All the cars stopped.
That was amazing.
That's real power.
Yes.
Not to be trifled with.
I mean, the idea that you would go against the wishes of the sign were just impossible to imagine. It was definitely a message from some higher power. Stop.
And as the years passed, Joe learned there are other abstract rules that also have power, also written in code. E equals mc squared, Newton's laws of motion, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. 15 years later, Joe was accepted at MIT, then became a computer scientist, then a respected software designer. But he told his professor, Sherry Turkle, that the stop sign was his first baby step to science, to an idea.
Just that there's an order, an underlying order of things. And this was definitely the first time, I think, that I understood that concept.
And the idea of hidden order he found so beautiful and so comforting that later on, when a truck happened to knock down the stop sign at the end of his block, his father pried it off, brought it home, just to keep him company.
And I promptly hung that up in my room, and I think that was hung up in my room all the way through college.
And for his family, this became a kind of theme. Joe loves stop signs, so we should give him. How many did they actually give you?
I had a little piggy bank, I guess a stoppy bank. I don't know what to call it.
Plus, he had a stop sign carpet,
which was knitted for me by my aunt, and I don't know how long that took.
But the sense that our universe has hidden laws that can be elegant, simple, powerful, that sense never left him. Nor, by the way, has the sign.
Oh, yes. It's in the basement because there are other rules that are imposed on me by my wife, which are, I think, more inviolable at this point than the rule on a stop sign. So it's in the basement, but I definitely still have it. I don't know what could make me willingly part with that.
Joe's story appears in a collection of essays called Falling for Science. I'm Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Oscar Hammerstein II authored such American musical theater classics as Showboat and Carousel, which were not only entertaining but had substance. New Coffee Table Book, The Complete Lyrics of Oscar Hammerstein II, covers the master's career. Jeff London met with Amy Ash, the book's editor, to look at how Mr. Hammerstein and his partner, Richard Rogers, worked on one moment in South Pacific.
Amy Ash has spent the last 7 years poking around archives and libraries, poring through boxes of sheet music, and leafing through scripts to come up with the definitive collection of Oscar Hammerstein's lyrics. How many lyrics are actually in this book?
850.
And how many of those lyrics are lyrics that have never been published before?
When I counted them up, it seemed as if about a quarter had never been published before.
Among the treasures Amy Ash has uncovered are lyrics written for but never used in classic Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals.
Oklahoma, South Pacific, King and I, they wrote more than they needed. They would write something and then realize a more effective way to do that moment, so they'd write a new song for that character and that occasion.
Like this occasion.
One of the last songs to be written for South Pacific was the love song that Lieutenant Cable, the young Princeton-educated lieutenant, would sing to the local girl that he's just had sex with. And it took Hammerstein and Rodgers several attempts to come up with a song that was satisfactory for the occasion.
The song they eventually came up with was this.
Younger than springtime are you, softer than starlight are you, warmer than winds of June are the gentle lips you gave me.
But before that, they wrote My Friend. Amy Ash reads a bit of the lyric.
Well, my friend, our day is at an end. Our next kiss will have to be our last. Soon, my friend, I'll be around the bend, alone with a dream already past.
Joshua Logan, South Pacific's director and co-author, wrote in his memoirs that when he heard the song, quote, I was so let down that I blurted out my first feelings. That's awful. That's the worst song I ever heard. Good God, that's terrible. They looked at me in shock. No one had ever spoken to them like that before, I'm sure.
So they made another attempt with a different melody, and that melody did not find a home in South Pacific, but will be familiar to people who know the great musicals.
Suddenly lovely, suddenly my life is lovely. Suddenly living certainly looks good to me. Suddenly happy, suddenly my heart is happy. Is it a girl? Could be, could be.
Recognize the tune? More on that later. Editor Amy Ash says Suddenly Lovely didn't exactly capture the dramatic moment.
It's kind of a chipper melody. It's not passionate, I don't think. It's happy, it's bouncy, but it's maybe not what a man says to the girl that he just made love to.
Still, Hammerstein went back to the drawing board and wrote a completely new lyric to the same tune.
Suddenly lucky, suddenly our arms are lucky. Suddenly lucky, suddenly our lips have kissed.
A better lyric, but is it appropriate for a Marine after having made love to a young girl to sing a song called Suddenly Lucky?
I don't know how that would have gone over in 1949. It is unintentionally amusing to us, for sure.
With time running out before the out-of-town tryout, Rodgers remembered an unused tune one of his daughters loved, and Hammerstein wrote a lyric to it.
They needed to nail that song, and in the last burst of inspiration, they wrote together the beautiful Younger Than Springtime.
And when you're you, and joy invade my arms and fill my heart as now they do, then younger than springtime am I, gayer than laughter am I, angel and
Suddenly Lovely, Suddenly Lucky? Well, a couple of years later, Rodgers and Hammerstein were in New Haven previewing a new show called The King and I, and they realized that Anna, the teacher played by Gertrude Lawrence, needed to sing a song to the Siamese children in the first act. And one of the stars of South Pacific came to Rodgers and Hammerstein's rescue, says Amy Ash.
Mary Martin said to them, "You remember that little dance, the little music that we used for a warm-up in South Pacific? You just did it for rehearsals? That would be a great tune." And so, Suddenly Lovely, Suddenly Lucky turned into Getting to Know You.
Getting to know you, getting to know all about you. Getting to like you, getting to hope you like me.
If you want to get to know Oscar Hammerstein better, there are more stories like this in The Complete Lyrics of Oscar Hammerstein II. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Special thanks to singer Jeff Harner and pianist Alex Rybeck for their renditions of Suddenly Lovely and Suddenly Lucky. To hear full renditions of both songs and to read the lyrics, you can come to our website, npr.org.
Getting to feel free and easy when I am with you.
Nice getting to know you here on Weekend Edition.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.